Hello, I'm Junius Williams, your host on the podcast, Everything's Political. And we're going to be very political today in a very subtle way. I've got some fantastic guests with me. Just so you all know that I wasn't fooling last time with that conversation about women. Once again, I have women who are going to be contributing to our understanding of our topic today, which is all about healing. How do we as organizers confront the need to heal? We had a young man on a previous episode. I first heard him with the conversation held with the National Council of Elders.
Are you talking about Praveen?
And he said one of the things they really need to do is to heal. He feels the need to do that. He's on the front line. He's out in the street in Detroit with the whole question of police and other things. So we all have had those kinds of experiences, but have we all done the healing that's necessary for ourselves, but maybe even more important, for other people that we want to work with? So I'm going to talk to these folks. The common denominator of the three people we have today is that they all deal with some aspect of organizing and some aspect of healing. First person I'm going to introduce is Shay Howell. She's a Detroit activist, co-founder of the James and Grace Lee Boggs Center in Detroit, and along with me, a member of the National Council of Elders. We're going to find out more about James and Grace Lee Boggs in a minute. The second person is Keisha Ure. She's director of the Office of Violence Prevention and Trauma Recovery in the city of Newark. She works directly with Mayor Raz Baraka. And the third one, the third person, last but certainly not least, is Kalina Berryman. She is a former director of the Abbott Leadership Institute and of the Youth Media Symposium. Along with me, as always, is Francesca Larson, who takes care of business with the organization side, but is also a co-host. So, hello to all of you.
Hello.
Good to see you. It's very good to see you.
Good to see you guys, too, and hear you. So, why is healing so important if we are dealing with people who consent to be organized? Let's start with you, Shay, because the Boggs Center is known as a place-based organizing organization. Tell us about the organization and about healing.
Well, you know, the whole idea about healing is something that we have this new generation to thank for bringing forward into the political world. When I first started working with Boggs Center in 1973, we thought the revolution might be happening tomorrow. And so you had to hurry up and keep at it and keep working. And this idea that healing, that personal development was part of revolution, was something that our generation didn't really share. And it's been, I think, two factors. One, with the women's movement emerging and the idea that the personal is political, we began to see this notion of healing. But also, I think from the community level, the tremendous amount of trauma that our communities, especially in cities like Detroit and Newark, the trauma that we've experienced is one that requires us to think very differently about who we are and our relationships to each other. So in Detroit, a lot of what shapes our current politics is the recognition that people at the community level have had to recreate life after abandonment. And that recreation means we've got to think about new relationships, new values, and who we are as capable creators. And in order to create, you have to have some sense of health. You can't create out of disease. So I think this moment calls for healing. And I think this generation has brought that forcefully into political discourse, for which I am very thankful when I see young folks on this.
Let me pick up with something that you said. The trauma we have experienced in places like Newark and Detroit. Keyword, trauma. Keisha, you're with the Office of Violence Prevention and Trauma Recovery. How did that office come into being, and how would you figure into this conversation?
So the Office of Violence Prevention and Trauma Recovery ultimately became a thing and came about in the wake of a crisis, right? In the wake of the George Floyd protests, where the country was organizing and protesting against police brutality, and the rallying cry was defunding of the police. And so the Office of Violence Prevention and Trauma Recovery came out of that wake where Mayor Raj J. Baraka did an ordinance, an executive order to create the office for us to be able to reallocate 5% of the police department's budget to create this office. Because while we had a national issue, we also had local issues around crime and violence increasing in our cities. So while we have police violence, we also have community violence, domestic violence, sexual violence, right? And all of those things need to be addressed. And so we put all of those things under one umbrella so that it's not so siloed and fractioned and everybody doing, you know, something different. And while they are doing something different, we needed to have a coordinated strategy. And so the office is the coordinated strategy that we needed in order to create some equity amongst community-based organizations, law enforcement, and city government, and bringing those things together. And while we're talking about healing and trauma, the office is trauma recovery. So we are being housed, and we have a space at the 17th Avenue precinct where police were once being housed. It was their precinct. And so a place where in the wake of the 67 rebellion, when we had police brutality happening, out of that precinct sparked another uprising and protest that was happening in the city. And so a place that was a place of people being arrested, a place where people were afraid and fear and lack of trust, is now a place where people can go and get help. And so this trauma recovery office and violence prevention office has transformed and helped us to change the game, where we build an equity with law enforcement is not the only game in town, where you can get help, public safety. We now have a community-based public safety strategy. And so we have social workers. So for every 10 police officers that get hired in the city, I get to hire a social worker. And the social workers are working alongside law enforcement, in front of law enforcement, behind law enforcement, to create safety in our communities, because we know that they can't do it alone. But we're ultimately getting to the root causes of crime and violence by addressing the emotional issues, social issues, mental health issues. And those are the areas that are not often looked at, the mental health, right? Why are people creating crime and violence? What's happening? What's the quality of life issues that we have? People are traumatized. We have shootings, robberies, carjackings, stabbings, all of these things, and it's business as usual. And so this office was created so that we don't have business as usual, that we're creating some awareness around these things, we're intervening, and we're having prevention and treatment. So we really have to go and mediate these situations. We're at the crime scenes, we're at the funerals, we're at the hospital, at the schools, at every part of the community where crime and violence is taking place. We have to be there. And so while we're talking about healing, right, we can't heal from what we're not willing to confront. And these are the things that we are confronting every day, that people are having issues around poverty. And violence is about poverty. Violence is about power and control. Violence is about lack of equity, all of the things that we know. And so the flip side of that is that we have some healing, and we have agencies that we are looking to fund to be able to help our communities heal. Mm-hmm. And so we have the bigger healing that has to happen, where we've burned down cities, right? And have those oppression, that's bigger healings that have to happen generationally. And then we're helping to heal the communities on a local and a more personal level.
See, that's why Mayor Baraka and I get along, because he must have read my book, Unfinished Agenda. because I said in there, the power in the suite must join the power in the streets.
Right.
And what Keisha is doing is an embodiment of that. You can't just rely on the power from the suites, which is in the city government. That's the police. That's the ultimate authority in the streets. But here's another example of how you organize with the help of city government. And I think that that has to be well known and further demonstrated. Keisha Urie is a great example of how that works and what she's doing. We're going to talk some more about that. But now let's talk about Kalina Berryman. Talk to Kalina Berryman. I have to say more about her because, you see, Kalina Berryman came to my attention as my administrative assistant, and she tells me that was about 16 years ago when I was in charge of the Abbott Leadership Institute and hadn't even thought about the Youth Media Symposium. I guess we were just beginning that. Mm-hmm. And Kalina just kind of grew in wisdom and stature, as one book says. And what she was able to do is to work with me and understand just how you run an organization. And now she's just left the Abbott Leadership Institute and the Youth Media Symposium, taking my place as the director of both. So this is, you know, upfront and personal. Kalina, you are right. So now the question to you is, you know, especially when we form the Youth Media Symposium, you can tell us what that is, but one of the things that we had to do, and you had a great deal to do with this, is to help those young people heal. Mm-hmm. As we got to know them, to empower them to become organizers, and to empower them to become advocates, you couldn't get away from the fact that there had to be a lot of healing done. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Yeah, so first of all, you never leave ALI. So I was just at ALI before I came here because that's family and that's forever. And yeah, I grew because I was empowered there. Mm-hmm. And I think what probably is something that we all have in common with our work is that we understand that everybody has a story and it just takes time for you to get to know it. And so there are certain common denominators in our work. And first, I think that you've set a culture at ALI where there's a process by which we empower people. And that first part is that you're seen. So we see you. And that's the desire we all have, is just to be seen in a beautiful way where people are saying, look, I see you. I value you. You are special to me. And whatever you have that has gone on in your life makes you even more beautiful to me in this moment. And I know for Keisha, for instance, when her team shows up in those hospitals when someone has been shot and they may be embarrassed because they know that their child is in a gang or doing illegal activity and they've been shot. But someone from Keisha's office comes and says, I see you. I value you. I'm here to help you. There's no judgment, that there's power in that. And so that's the first thing we do is we let people, young people, parents know that you're seen. Mm-hmm. And then we create an atmosphere of belonging. So we see you and you belong here. You belong here. You're a part of us. You're one of us. This is a space where you are safe. And then from that, they develop their voice. And that comes in when we talk about advocacy and policy and education, and we develop these strong leaders. But what we find is that part of voice and speaking truth to power is also speaking truth to yourself. And that's when young people start to come to us and say, this has happened to me. And my dad did this and my mom did this. And these are the struggles that I have. And their parents start to tell you their truths. But they feel like they can because they're coming to you from a place of power and confidence versus a place of defeat. And so that has been the evolution of YMS and ALI and why we have young people who started with us as children, sixth grade, and are now about to graduate college because of that trust we've developed, that belonging, and through empowering them, they have healed, and now they heal each other, and they are healing the next generation. And I think that's just a beautiful part of all of our work that really is what makes better communities.
I'm listening to you, and when I was looking at you talking about this, I was thinking about some of our young people who are not only in Newark, but kind of like all over the country. Now they are doing their thing, and they probably wouldn't have been able to do that if they hadn't been empowered. And as you put it, to empower first is to deal with your demons.
Absolutely.
And that's what's happening. That's what's happening on all three fronts. So, Francesca, what do you have to say about that? I'm going to turn it over to you. I've talked about it, and I think it's time for you to chime in.
I appreciate it. And I'm sitting here soaking everything in, and I've heard this word healing a lot. And I was even thinking that it's come up in pop culture now, that the work that you're doing, Keisha and Nork, has transferred into seasons of The Rookie show, where they're talking about this on a national stage at 8 o'clock at night on network television, which feels very new. But Kalina, with what you were saying, is you started to get into that recipe of what does healing actually look like. And so to Shay and to Keisha, I'd love to know what your thoughts are there too. What is the recipe for healing right now? What does healing actually mean in practice?
Well, you know, Kalina, when you were talking, what I thought about was how often people talk about healing as though it's an individual thing. And the very first thing you said was, you have to be seen, which requires a relationship. And, you know, before we started, Junius and I were talking about Jimmy and Grace Boggs always had this idea that the purpose of revolution is to make us more human beings. And that means to be human is to be in relationship. So I think this notion, what you were saying about both seeing and belonging, those are critical elements for us to heal, because it says we don't get sick by ourselves and we don't get healed by ourselves. And that the end of healing isn't just a stronger self, it's a stronger place. So, you know, here we have this notion about urban gardens. We've got hundreds and hundreds of urban gardens. We're in the planting season now. But every urban gardener says the purpose of these gardens is to create community. We grow community, not just food.
That's right.
And I think a piece of it, it's the most intergenerational activity in the whole city. You know, there's little kids and elders all together, and they heal each other. They help each other, and they're healing the earth.
Keisha, I saw you shaking your head a little bit with that. Please feel free to jump in and respond and add your thoughts. Nobody has to wait for myself or Junius to ask a question too.
So Shay is on point, and Kalina, in terms of healing is so abstract, right? That if you don't know what it looks like and even what it feels like, but we certainly have some sense of, right? And so with it being abstract, they're like, well, what is the secret sauce? How do you do it, right? And there's no blueprint to healing. And it's ultimately you doing the work on yourself, you accessing resources and accessing and having access to things that can help you, whether that's safety, security. Those are the things, right, that help people to be able to heal and not feel like they are unsafe and they have anxiety and they're stressed about what's going to happen, homelessness, right? Those things, people that are in fires, people who don't have jobs and get laid off. They don't have a sense of security. And if they're continuously faced with hardship and continuously faced with tribulations, then they know they don't have a safety net and don't have a place to land. And so for some of us, healing just looks like a place that we call home, right? Like Kalina said, a place of belonging. Healing for me is a safe place. And you know, for me, I got into this work because I had a boyfriend of mine was shot and killed, right, in the city of Newark. My brother was shot by the police. And the person who shot my brother came to my house and I opened the door and had a whole conversation with him, not knowing that that was his intent. I was home from college for the weekend. And when I'm in college, I'm safe, secure, just going to school. I don't have to worry about anything. But when I came home to Newark, it was a different reality. And so from that time, I moved out the city. Like overnight, I had to move because I saw the person who shot him. And if he knocked on the door one time, he would knock again. And so my sense of safety and my sense of security was gone. And I was always afraid and living in fear. And so that's not a healthy place. And so I was violated, right? And being robbed and whatever happens to you, right? That's what trauma is about. Something happened to you versus, you know, anything else. And so having to really work through those things, getting some tools in your tool belt to help you be able to cope better, have better safety strategies, have better stress and coping mechanisms, things that we don't get taught, right? And so we're always in survival mode. And in survival mode, you're just to survive, and that's all you have to do. But healing looks like you're thriving. Healing looks like you are living. Healing looks like you get to live where you want to live. You get to buy the car you want. You get to pay your bills and not worry about anything. You get to have friends and family and children and, you know, whatever the American dream is, if you will. But many of us don't have that reality. So many of us don't have that reality. And so healing for some of us just looks like having a safe place to be and to go every day and being able to eat. And so in sharing that, I am just getting to a place, and that happened 20 years ago, where I can unpack boxes and live somewhere safe and not have to look out my window and be scared that somebody's going to come knock on my door again.
Yeah. And I think racism thrives in an unhealed world. You know, we need to be unhealed and broken for racism to continue to impact our lives. Because once people start healing and understanding their power, then you cannot oppress. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I know that's why they don't want critical race theory in schools. They don't want us talking about these things because y'all might mess around and get healed.
Right.
And then we can't shut you out and shut you down the way that we've historically been able to do. And I tell you, the young people today, they are healing. They are doing yoga. They are going to therapy. Mm-hmm. They are demanding to be paid fairly. Mm-hmm. They want to work from home. They're not playing. You know, and I love, one of the things I love about ALI is that, for instance, and I'll just go back to Keisha again, if you live in a community like Newark, where we grew up, you are always surrounded by negative things that break your spirit, break who you are. And even the most empowered young person has a bit of that in them. Mm-hmm. But then when you come to spaces like ALI, you start to learn your history. Mm-hmm. You start to learn why your community is set up, right? And then you read books like Unfinished Agenda and you hear about the medical school agreement and how Black folks were able to make that happen. And you kind of learn how your city, the infrastructure came to be. And you see a city differently.
Right.
But then you see your mama differently and you see your grandmama differently. And you see your uncles and your aunts differently. You say, oh, okay, Uncle such and such was on drugs, but that was a part of the 80s, the plan, you know. Yeah, and you start to have empathy.
Right.
And you start to understand yourself and your lineage differently. And then you start to ask the world some questions and hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. And now they can't treat you the way they were able to treat your mother or treat your uncle or your aunt. So there's power in healing. And I think that that's something that we have to continue to advocate for and to allow spaces for young people, especially young professionals, to heal. Because what I found now with YMS is that these young people are showing up in spaces that are not ready for the healed version of them. Mm-hmm. And they are saying, I'm not going to take this. And Black older people are trying to make them bow down. And they're like, oh, we're not going to do it. So I think for us, our challenge now, for my generation in particular, for our generation, is when these young people come to us demanding more, what are we going to do about that? Mm-hmm. How are we going to protect them? And so, you know, that's our work at this point, is protecting the healed version of our children.
And if our people that we're going to are not healed, then they continue to perpetuate, right? The trauma and all of those things. And so we have to, like she said, prepare our young people for an unhealed world, an unhealed family that don't know how to accept them when they come and say, we want to go to therapy. And we know that our grandmothers say, what happens in the house stays in the house, right? We don't need to go talk to nobody about our problems. And we're like, no, therapy is the culture now, right? And I'm a therapist. Mm-hmm. Right. And so seeing so many young people and people now in therapy not feeling stigmatized by it anymore is healing.
Absolutely.
And let me take that a step further, because if that healed version shows up, whether you're working Lakeisha's version or Kalina's version or Shay's version, when that healed person shows up and raises his or her head, inevitably, they're going to get involved with the whole question of social justice, not just for themselves, but for other people as well, which leads to the politics of confrontation, which is why people like Praveen and the rest of these young people that are out here on the front line, sometimes constantly, day after day, just like we were back 50 years ago with SNCC and SDS, there has to be some kind of way that people like that get the kind of healing that they need. So what do you suggest, Shay? I mean, Praveen is in Detroit. What are y'all doing when you say that you are a place-based organization or you are into place-based organizing? What are you doing to help people like that?
Well, I think that some of it is what we've just been talking about. One of the things that has happened with the young people on the streets is all of the older folks, older activists in the community, almost immediately, as soon as it jumped off, we organized a major coalition to make a public statement in support of the young people. So we said, essentially, we said what you said, Lakeisha. We said, we see you, you belong to us, and we're putting our arms around you. And we have tried to maintain, as elders, support for these young people. The second thing we've done is we've tried to provide a platform where they can use their voice to describe what they see happening. So in Riverwise, our magazine that comes out quarterly, there's a section where the Detroit Will Breathe folks like Praveen are clearly able to talk about what's going on and work through some of the major issues that they're facing. And the third thing is we've taken study seriously. We're about to start a Freedom University on March 12th. And the number one thing we're going to read is Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, so we can understand the back forces that have shaped us. And then we're going to move up forward through the history of Detroit bankruptcy and then take a look at the community responses. Because the kind of damage that is done is not just physical damage, it's psychic damage. And as you were saying, it's the damage that erases our history. It's the damage that for African Americans never looks at the struggles for change. And for European Americans, it wipes out any European except John Brown who ever stood against injustice. You know, he's the only one we ever hear about. And he got killed, not a role model. So how we think is something that we're trying to do in an intergenerational context. And the other thing we're trying to do is very intentionally create intergenerational relationships where the experiences are experiences that can come around these folks. I don't know what, you've got great public officials in Newark. We don't in Detroit. Our young people are experiencing a kind of assault from the police and the state that belongs in 1955. That's what it looks like. That's what it feels like. And the weight of it on them has been so heavy. And so our job is to put our arms around them and to really try to create a kind of radical love that says, as you said, not just that we see you, but we're here to protect you and support you. So those are the kinds of things we're doing. There's way more to be done, but that's definitely a beginning.
Yeah, I think each generation has a different charge. I think, Mr. Williams, you know, you all created the door. And our generation is holding the door open and putting the carpet. And their generation is breaking that door down because we don't need it anymore. We're here. And so for me, how I personally support the young leaders and the fighters that come out of ALI is I want them to do three things. And I let them remind them and make a way for them to do it. One is to create. I want them to have the freedom to create the lives that they want for themselves. And that's something that, Mr. Williams, maybe y'all couldn't necessarily do because the fight was so difficult and we couldn't really imagine it, you know, so now they can. So we're saying you need the space to create the life that you want because joy is justice. Justice is not spending your whole life fighting. All my life I had to fight. No, we want you to be able to create beautiful things. And then we want them to be able to dream, to dream for themselves and for their children unapologetically. You do not have to sacrifice your life for the struggle. We want you to add to it, but the sacrifices have been made. We need you to know what they were, respect them, and now take advantage of them. So we want them to dream. And then last, I want them to rest. I just left and one of our kids is going to Paris. And I'm like, you go, girl. But why? Because we have made sure that they are financially able to do that. And so the ability to create, dream, and rest comes from financial freedom. And so for me, I make sure that our young people are paid well, that they understand that they can be entrepreneurs, and I connect them to vast amounts of opportunity to make money and to build wealth, because they deserve, from all of our work and efforts, the right to create, dream, and rest. And that keeps them fighting and thinking about new ways to make the world better. So, you know, that's my thing right now is the 18 to 24 year olds. How are we going to make sure that they get to enjoy this world and not have to continue to have to sacrifice joy for the struggle?
Francesca?
I'm letting Kalina soak in and I'm taking some notes here. Create, dream, rest. And I'm wondering, Keisha, that you might see some of these folks before they get to Kalina. What comes before having the freedom to create? What is allowed to happen in your trauma recovery space? What are the tactical elements that are happening there? What are the feelings that are happening in that space? For those of us who haven't been there yet, what can we expect?
So the space is still being built out. And one of the things that I did not mention is that there's going to be a museum, a conflict resolution museum there, that Mr. Williams has been, you know, working and spearheading and pulling together so that the stories are told, so that the history is not forgotten. And that's one of the things, like Kalina said, like the history, right, that they have to know where they come from. They have to know why things are happening. Like Shay said, teaching them underdeveloped Africa, right, how Europe underdeveloped Africa, those things. So the teaching, you know, has to happen. So the building space is not up and running yet, but we do have our social workers, our outreach workers, and our Brick City Peace Collective is there until we begin the renovation. But ultimately in our community spaces, right, that looks like life skills, right? That looks like them learning about themselves, learning rites of passage, learning why we are in these incidences that we have. But many of the young people and adults that we get are coming from the criminal justice system, unfortunately. So I have a social worker in the juvenile detention center in the jail and also at adult processing at 480 Clinton Avenue. And when I hire more social workers, they'll be in each precinct. And so, unfortunately, that's where they are coming from. And we're not getting them sooner than that, right? That we should be really engaging them before they get to that point. And so I have social work at the school. I do have a couple in the schools where we have a satellite for the Shani Baraka Center. We are addressing domestic violence and sexual assault already at teenage years, 12, 13, 14, 15. We are doing that work before they get to Kalina, after they get to Kalina, and during, you know, that age. So it's happening all at the same time. But the trauma recovery portion, recovery is forever, right? Recovery is a process. And they need to know that, that there is a process in the recovery, and there's stages to change, and there's stages to grief, and there's stages to all of these things. And a lot of times we just want to skip it and get right to the destination, right? And so many of our young people at this generation of them, this is the microwave era, where they want it right now, right now, right now. And they don't want to go through what it takes to get there. And we still trying to teach them, right? Life is about the journey. And they're like, no, this is about the destination. And so really having people in their lives and role models and people in our communities that can help show them rather than just talking at them and telling them. And so we're really trying to develop this at every stage. And so it's in the works and it's in the process. And so that's where I am. Still, I'm flying this plane. I'm driving the plane. I'm fixing the plane. I'm designing the plane. And so it's all happening all at the same time. And so I don't know where we are. I just know that we are in the process. because everything matters, right? Nothing is more important, but I got to prioritize. So everything matters. The youth house, the adults, the schools, the hospital. We have a hospital violence intervention program, right? So the hospital, so every place and every institution matters. So it's in the works.
Go ahead, Shay.
I was just going to say, Keisha, you know, we have a organization here called SOSAT, Save Our Sons and Daughters. It was started in the 80s by mothers who lost their children to handgun violence.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about them a lot because I was thinking about healing. And as you're talking, one of the things that happened here was the woman who founded SOSAT, Clem Barfield, used to say, every time a child is murdered, we lose two, one to the grave and one to prison.
Right.
And what we found was often the child who went to prison lost his family because they were ashamed and embarrassed and didn't want to deal. And so Clem got the mothers who had lost their son to death, meet with the young man who had killed their son. And often those two people became a lifeline for each other. And, you know, we were talking about what it means to be human. To me, that capacity to connect over such tragedy and to recognize what's lost and your part in each of that has been, it was a tremendous experience to be able to witness. And I, when I think of the work you're doing, the potential that that has to really transform people is so critical. And then I think about you, and I hope you're going for create and joy and rest, because I know how heart pushing that kind of work is, to just be present for people every day.
Absolutely.
And it's, yeah, it's just, it requires people saying, you know, you need to care for you too.
I hear what both of you are saying, and I think I want to believe that that's possible, because, yes, create, yes, that's what we're doing all the time. You know, our work is kind of like a jazz musician. You got to improvise. You want to dream because you got to think of the next riff. But rest?
Right.
You were right, Kalina. I mean, the older generation, we had a song even. Freedom is a constant struggle.
Right.
They say that freedom is a constant struggle, and it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if once we train people and once we motivate them and they take over their own self-development and they understand organization, I don't know if there's going to be time for rest, quite frankly. I mean, I look at me.
Right.
I saw the other day somebody did an interview of me, and they said, oh, he's a septuagenarian. I said, who's that? A septuagenarian? and I am. That's the first time I realized that I am a septuagenarian. And I ain't resting that much. So how are we going to do that? Because I know that I have some skills, and I see the injustice, and I want to go after it. How are you going to rest?
But, well, here's the thing. They don't have it. So one thing is, if we're not resting more, then we're not doing the right work. Something's wrong. Because rest is a form of revolution. And so your work, I didn't really get to rest too much, but I love that the young people are able to, because that means that we've done our job. That means that we've made things better for them, and they have the freedom to occasionally think about rest. But here's why it's so necessary. I think that in your time, revolution was a part of a culture. Activism was the culture. You know, it was a movement. It was something that you did. It was large organizations for it. It was a part of the fabric of that time. Today, it's not really. So there are far less of them, and it's far more off to the side. And most of the time, they hang with old people, right? They hang with us. They hang with you. And so for them to continue to want to do this work when it's not as popular, you know, of course, there's some
Black Lives Matter movement, social media things, but I'm talking about our young people who are really in the trenches and doing the work on a day-to-day basis. The ones that are right now, like Jennifer and Israel with YMS as we speak, helping to build the next generation of leaders. Their peers are not doing this work. And so for them to continue to be motivated, they mm-hmm. have to take the time to rest because it's heavy and it's lonely. And so, you know, I find joy in their rest. I feel like I did something right. And I think we got to change how we see the way that we work, because otherwise, what's the point of it? You know, the world has to get better at some point for our people. And the amount of rest that we are able to have kind of signifies that we're moving in the right direction.
But what if it doesn't?
Well, what I'm hearing is, and I'm watching this happen, I'm watching what I'm about to say happen, which is the modeling, the way that Keisha shared her story, the way that Keisha, you shared your story at the beginning of this, of how you found your path to healing, how Shay just modeled for us to ask Keisha and Kalina, how are you continuing to heal yourselves and find rest? That is how we do it. It's by modeling it for each other. It's by asking one another what we're doing. It's by showing each other what we can do. So when Mr. Williams, I tell you, I'm taking a vacation.
We mean it.
Yeah. And it's not just for me, but I take intention in what I put in my out of office message, that I'm taking time to reflect on blank. I'm having a moment to connect with my family, to see the world through my daughter's eyes, because that's what I want my team to do too. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to do it unless we have it modeled for us.
Yeah.
Well, let's agree with this. Once you get to be 75, then you can rest.
and that's certainly a thing.
But there ain't no time for resting right now.
What do they say? No rest for the weary.
Well, yeah, that's right. I want to come back at you on that, Kalina, because you said maybe we didn't do the right thing because we don't have time. Or maybe we saw that what has been created and dreamed has not been really developed, and so we have to keep on carrying it through.
Yeah, we come back and we get back from Jamaica, we keep on working.
I would make a distinction between rest and being satisfied. I don't think we should be satisfied, but I definitely think we should rest, because one of the things we learned is you can make some really bad decisions. You can do some really awful stuff when you're tired. And I think rest might be not the, you know, it fits nice, it's an easy word, but what we're talking about is soul feeding. We're talking about being able to ground ourselves and come back with new eyes. And that's critical. And if it happens under the name of rest, that's great. If it happens under the name of listening to music after the show, that's what it is. But to recognize we have to feed our souls, not just our bodies. We have to feed our spirits. And that's what rest's about.
Right.
Well, now, I agree with that. See, I had an organization called NAPA, Newark Area Planning Association.
Uh-huh.
And we fought all kinds of urban renewal, highways, medical school takeovers. And there were other people doing something similar or part of what we were doing in Newark at that time. This was in the 60s. And in the little office that we had, every Thursday night, we had what was called NAPA Soul Sessions. I'm uh-huh. coming on to what you're saying, Shay. We had music. Mm-hmm. We had a drink that I can't say the name of it, but the initials are MF. That's because we had a Kool-Aid base. We mm-hmm. put ice in it. And whoever had some liquor at that time brought and put that liquor in there. Mm-hmm. And after you drank one cup of that, you said, that's a mm-hmm. That's how the drink got its name. You're shaking your head, Keisha, but I'm dropping science here. I'm going along with what Shay is saying. You got to find some kind of way to nurture your soul. That mm-hmm. I agree with.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
That I agree with. And then we did it. We sat down and we said, okay, what we're going to do tomorrow, and we were right back out there on the front line. You have any words of wisdom?
I think I've yawned probably 30 times, but rest is hard. Rest is certainly hard for those of us who are workers, those of us who are task people who want to see outcomes. And many of us think we got to do it ourselves. And many of us are not good delegators. So let me speak about me. And so because it's a lot of pressure and all eyes are watching, and my Office of Violence Prevention and Trauma Recovery is being looked at as a national model, and it can't fail, then the pressure doesn't allow you to rest even when you are supposed to be resting. So I went to St. Martin a month ago, and then I went to Cabo to follow a month, and I do something once a month, but my laptop is open, my phone is on the Wi-Fi, the mayor is still calling. And so rest is, you know, however we can get it, but it's certainly a lot of pressure when you have these models and it's the first time that things are happening. And we know that by reallocating 5% of the police department's budget, everybody ain't happy, right? And some other cities have given the money back to the police and taken the money back from community-based organizations. And so they're looking to see if that's going to happen here. And so it can't fail. And so rest, you know, for the weary, right, is a little bit harder to happen. But we know that, like Kalina talked about, the struggle, right, it's protracted, right? And we're going to be in struggle, you know, for a long time. But we do have to take the moments to have joy. We do have to have the moments to create and to be able to celebrate a little bit. Because what I find culturally for us is that we don't have a lot of celebrations that we do. And we have to, you know, create our celebrations and celebrate however we can the small victories. And so rest is important. And it just looks different for everyone. And some people find comfort in work. So,
yeah. I mean, you know, and it's not about putting it down, but it's about making sure that you don't have children, you have to heal. You know, like at some point, things have to get better. And every time I rest, I say, thank you. I say, thank you, Junius Williams, for giving me access to all of these important people who can help me become more financially stable so that rest is even an option for me. Because it wasn't for my mom and daddy. They didn't start going on vacations until they were in their 50s because they couldn't afford to. So thank you. You know, thank you to those who fought for us to be able to go to Rutgers University Newark and sat in, because now I have a master's degree, which gives me the flexibility to have the job that I need where I can afford to rest or let my son take harmonica lessons so he can be like Mr. Williams. You know, rest is being able to go to enjoy a play and have culture. So absolutely, rest is us paying homage to you, because that means that you did something right. And so when I see these young people able to rest, I give there's no more thank you to me than that. And I know that they are going to raise stronger children, because they're going to be able to show their children a better world. And their children won't need as much healing, but they'll be powerful and they will know how to sing the song of freedom, and they will be able to fight for justice, and we'll just keep getting better and better and better. And so absolutely, you know, I say thank you to all of those who made it possible for me to sometime even imagine taking a rest.
You left me speechless. Which is hard to do, as you know.
Yes.
Francesca, you want to close us out?
I just want to keep on this theme. And Keisha, you said it, is we need to celebrate. So what are we celebrating today? Shay, Keisha, Kalina, tell our listeners what we're celebrating. What are you celebrating in your work?
You know, I am celebrating the kind of creativity that pulls the past into the future. We have this program for community safety called Green Chairs, and it's young people making chairs for old people to put on their porch so the old people can sit on the porch and watch the kids walk to school. And the idea is restoring the front porch, right? What we used to have in order to have a different future. So I'm celebrating that kind of creativity today.
I think I'm celebrating something that Ms. Shay, you said earlier about this multi-generational, intergenerational, powerful, you know, NORC is like, it's been an honor just to be a part of this work, because I am surrounded by elders. I know there's a book, The Takeover. And then I think in the first chapter, it talks about how this young man went to a school board meeting. And what he was most astounded by was that it was a room full of elders there, like the Council of Elders, and they were concerned about the North Public Schools. And so I've had this beautiful experience over the last 15, 16 years of being surrounded by brilliant elders and then, you know, parents that were a little younger than me and then these young people. And we've grown up and out together. And so I'm celebrating that. I look around and they're still with me. I'm no longer at ALI in a formal way, but I still speak to these people every day. They are still a part of my community and they keep me healed. They keep me happy. They keep me fed. And so today I celebrate them and the ability now, all these years later, to sit on Mr. Williams' podcast, Everything's Political, and talk about the great work that we've done. So that's what I'm celebrating.
And so we are celebrating all things political, which is a great thing because we are normally on all politics are local, right? And so that's it teaches us that we have to be involved in the process. Right. And that politics is everything. Right. And we know people say, I don't do politics, but politics is everything and you have to do it. And it's how it creates pathways for us to be able to get to the next level. And so I'm celebrating social work. Right. And being able to be in this position as a social worker, because before social workers were stigmatized as the people who take your children. Right. And not really as the change agents. Mm-hmm. And so being able to have social work. Social workers in a police department, social workers having equity, social workers being able to be seen as the people who, when you don't know what to do, then these are the people that you call, being problem solvers, right? Being people to be able to help. And so with that, I received an email saying that I'm going to be awarded Social Worker of the Year from the National Association of Social Workers for the New Jersey chapter, right?
Absolutely.
They never saw social work and activism and social justice and all of those things as being things to award before. And so I want to be able to move the needle with them with community organizing because it's not being taught in the schools anymore. And that they continue to keep that because that's what makes us who we are. We have to be able to transform communities and transform our oppression, right, into, you know, ways to be able to make change and for it not to be seen as a bad thing. People who push the needle, people confrontation, like Mr. Junior said, right? People who are the troublemakers of the world ultimately are making the changes for to be able to build the pathways for the Kalina, the youth to be able to pass through. Someone has to kick the door in. Someone has to open the door and hold the door. And someone has to walk through unafraid, unapologetic, knowing the mission. And so I'm excited to be a part of that change.
Well, it don't get no better than that, as they say it in the hood. So on that note, I want to thank you all. I'm celebrating the fact that I'm here today with you all, that God has blessed me and you all have supported me so that I can actually be a part of this program and to sit here and to learn and to celebrate with you all. And to give thanks to Francesca for her help and her insight. She balances me out. And we're going to be back at you pretty soon. Just to give you a hint, we're going to be talking about voting the next time, the power of the vote. And because, you know, I reached out for people to be on the program and they all said, well, we're going to be in Selma. Because this is this 57th anniversary of the Selma to Montgomery March, of which I was a part. Most of the time I spent in jail and in prison, but I was part of it. And so somebody said, well, you ought to go. So I'm going. And you will be listening to some of the voices that I heard telling me why they still believe in the vote and what we're going to have to do to protect it. So on that note, good evening. Thank you all. See you next time.
Thank you.
Power to the people.
This is Junius Williams, your host on Everything's Political. Everything's Political podcast is sponsored by the Center for Education and Juvenile Justice and supported by the Terrell Foundation and listeners like you. It is produced by Mosaic Strategies, with theme music by Anthony Ant Jackson. Like what you hear? Subscribe to Everything's Political Podcast on Spotify and follow us on Facebook and Instagram for exclusive behind-the-scenes content.